Welcome to part two of our interview about the old Charleston jail as we talk with Randy Johnson about the many haunting experiences within those cell blocks. Randy, I want to ask, this is very much an opinion-based question, but you being a ghost hunter out there, someone who's experienced quite a bit and has seen the technology that's available for ghost hunting evolve tremendously in the last 10 to 15 years, where do you see that technology, that level of communication being 20, 30 years from now, when someone would go into a place like the old Charleston jail? What kind of interactions do you think will occur, and what do you think will be available for investigators at that time?
To answer that question, let me just premise it by saying, because it's going to affect my answer, what do I think it really is? What is going on? And in my personal the element of paranormal contact has to do with distortions in the fabric of time and space. I'm not completely convinced that that it's simply an isolated thing. I think it happens quite frequently, and people just aren't aware of it or try to block it out. But I do believe that when we encounter a spirit, say in the jail, it is quite possible that spirit is locked in a previous time. In other words, that spirit is still in a body, in existence, in a dimension where it still appears real to itself. And when we see it, it sees us in the same light. We appear as a ghost to it. Now, that's just a theory, but what it does is it touches upon what's going on here, what's the causation of all this. And I think that it does have something to do with distortions in the fabric of time and space. Edgar Allan Poe was onto this in the 1830s. And I think that the instruments that are going to be most compelling to us, the ones that are going to lead us to further discoveries, are going to be instruments that can somehow measure distortions in time or measure distortions in space. And once we know, once we encounter those, and sometimes there are places that have more of that than other places, and I think that's one of the reasons the jail is so active from a paranormal standpoint. There's been so much suffering, so much emotion, that it has pulled space and time into some sort of vortex. And if we find instruments that can detect that, I think it's going to lead us into windows where we have more direct contact, more backing and forcing. And so in the year 2040, I could see a group going in there, and this is just a vision I have. They're laying wires, coded wires, through the building, running down the hallways, into the rooms, and there are measurements at the ends of each of these tubes, or whatever you want to call them, and they're able to perceive these distortions. And then folks who are in the investigations can then gravitate toward those points as they move, and then we have a greater opportunity to interact with them.
You had mentioned in the first part of our interview about the escape attempt that was made by Lavinia's husband, where he ended up being caught, but John had quite a story of his attempt to get away from ultimately death. Can you share that story with us?
Lavinia is very active in the jail. If you go on our website or go to our online reviews, go to our Facebook page, you will see photographs people have posted, even recent photographs, of people who've been attacked by Lavinia. And what she does is she comes up behind people, she takes three fingers, and she scratches people. And at first, they don't know it. They may feel something. Maybe it'll feel like a rash. And eventually, you'll ask somebody, could you look at my back? And when they pull up their shirt, they see three distinct scratches going across their back. And Lavinia has this thing for younger men. She tends to focus on younger men. And Joy, my fiance, and I have seen this happen repeatedly. And we even warn younger men, you know, be careful, be on the lookout. She may mess with you. And it just depends on her mood. But Joy has had other interactions with Lavinia, and I think it's because she's a woman. I think Lavinia's, because of her history, very reluctant to discuss things with men. But women seem to have had more luck communicating with her. And I can talk about that too, but let me answer your question about the escape. After their sentence, they're taken up to the third floor, which was death row. And the original jail back in the 1820s was made of tabby, which is ground up oyster shells mixed with lime and sand and mud, and it's not a hard substance. And prisoners who were placed in cages that happened to open up against the outer walls were known to dig holes and escape, as crazy as that may sound. And they later took measures to stop that. But in the beginning, it was easy to get out of there if you wanted to. And there weren't guards on duty at night. Guards left. The only person at that jail holding down the fort at night back in the 1810s, 1820s, would have been the warden. And he's way down the hallway in his own private apartment, probably asleep. So John dug a hole and got out one night. Lavinia's with him. They're still together. And they're desperate because they know that in just a matter of a week or so, they're going to be swinging from ropes. So they're desperate. And John squeezes through the hole. He and Lavinia had tied two sheets together and used them as a rope. He lowers himself, and the plan was for her to follow him. But as he's lowering the ropes, they rip, and he hits the ground. It's about 20 feet down. He's not hurt. And this is where the story gets very interesting and somewhat romantic. He looks up at her. She can't jump. It's too far. And they're trying to be quiet, but he can't leave her. And he starts to walk back to the front of the jail with every intention of banging on the front door to wake up the warden so he can let him back in to be with his wife, because he can't stand the thought of her being up there without him to defend her. Well, she stops him. She waves him back and somehow communicates to him that he should take a run for it. Go for it. Go. So he finally listens to her. He runs over. He scales the wall, which could be done back then. And he runs off into the marsh. And we don't know exactly what happened, but we do know that on the day of their execution, both of them spoke to a Baptist minister by the name of Furman. And they told this minister that after he scaled the wall and went off into the marsh to hide, that he tried to get a gang together, the same gang that had been committing some of the highway theft and robberies up near Six Mile Wayfarers Inn, to help him bust her out of the jail. But he stayed close. He didn't run away. He didn't try to get off and disappear into history and leave her to face death on her own. He continued to stay very close to the jail. And because of that, within 2 days, he was recaptured. They found him sleeping under an overturned boat on the banks of the Ashley River. And they pull him in and throw him back in the cage. And, of course, within a week or so, they were both dead. But I always tell folks, I say, listen, if you're looking for a definition of love, I think we just found it.
Tell us more about Lavinia and some of the interactions that you've had, that the guests have had, that other investigators have had in the jail.
Well, one thing, the story, as Joy told it to me, gave me creeps. Joy was with a clairvoyant, a medium. And we do get a number of mediums who come on the tours and take the investigation. Sometimes they'll tell you they have a gift. Sometimes they won't. But this particular clairvoyant, a woman named Angela, whom Joy and I were both very enamored with, a very wonderful woman, had come here all the way from Los Angeles. And she came with a purpose. She had heard about Lavinia online and was fascinated by her story and was somehow moved emotionally by it. She felt sorry for Lavinia. She thought Lavinia had been horribly mistreated, that she was not guilty of these terrible crimes. And so there are many people who believe that, but she actually was not involved in these murders at all and was quite innocent, that it was actually her husband and his gang who committed these crimes. But she felt that this draw. And so she came all the way here from California, from Long Beach, to be here with us. She went on the regular tour. I met her, and I said, you've got to come back and do the investigation with us. We'd love to have you. We'd love to have your gift. And so she came back, and she and Joy went off by themselves up into the room where Lavinia had been kept and sat. And this woman began to speak, and she spoke directly to Lavinia. And she expressed her love for her, for compassion, you know, telling her, madam, I am so sorry what happened to you. Today, it would not be like that. You would be treated very differently. We are so sorry these terrible things happened to you. And Joy said that at that moment, something filled the room. And both of them were convinced that it was Lavinia. Of course, the meters light up. And They both felt her presence, and it was as if Lavinia was saying, thank you. And I don't know, it moved me. And Joy was noticeably upset about it, but in a good way. You know, it was a very special moment. And that has happened a few other times where women have expressed, you know, an identity with her and support for her, and she has responded likewise. She's like, all at one point, did not happen in my presence, but someone told me once they actually felt her hug the person. So she's real. She is real.
You mentioned earlier in the interview that the prison itself was built on burial grounds, Potter's Field. And this prison obviously built in the mid to early 1800s. So there's quite, I'm sure, a storied history of who was buried beneath the grounds of the prison, how many were buried beneath the grounds of the prison. I want to ask this about that. With this being a building that all the way to the 1930s was operated with such little respect for human life, even for little respect to human life of those who may have been deserving of harsh treatment because of horrible crimes that they committed, but certainly several not so much. Just being a human being and to treat others in such inhumane ways in a building that literally had no electricity, no running water, no plumbing, all the way into an era where those things existed readily available. Do you think that the negative energy that was conjured up from building a prison on top of a burial ground, it's negative on top of negative, essentially. Do you think that there's any rooted negative energy that just essentially, for a lack of a better term, could seep through this building? And do you think it played any sort of role in influencing those who were making the choices of how to run this place and maintain this place to the extent that they did, with such cruelty and such inhumanity through the years of it being an active jail? Do you think that the graves, the souls buried beneath the prison, played a role in that?
I do, absolutely. And what happened was, when the settlers arrived, of course they're terrified, didn't know what they were facing. They built a walled city, which they called Charlestown. And the walled city was far removed from the site of the jail. And there's a story that a French Huguenot family came from France with a deed already prearranged. They were called the Mazeques. And the Mazeques had title to the land that the jail is sitting on. They went out there to look at it and realized that they had been duped, that this was not land that they wanted. It was very low-lying, tied land. And so they went back to the city and tendered their deed and said, can we switch this for something else? That's how the city wound up with it. And so from that point on, the city's like scratching its head. What do we do with this property? And of course, typical of Charleston, we have a lot of dead bodies. Let's stick them there. And these were poor people. Now, if you were highborn, if you were a person of a higher level of socioeconomic status in Charleston, you were buried on high ground, on a ridge that ran through the old walled city of Charlestown. And so you were what we would consider a typical gravesite. But if you were poor, you weren't buried in the old walled city. They'd pull you out, take you down to this property, and put you in a shallow grave 2 to 3 feet deep. They would barely ever mark them. If they used any markers at all, they were wooden crosses, that none of which have survived. And over the years, they packed thousands of people in this lot. And essentially what they were doing was using bodies as landfill, and not knowing it, but that's what they were doing. And then finally, and so most of these people were transients. There were a lot of thieves who were buried there. These are people who would have had terrible lives and probably died horrible deaths in poverty, and probably under very difficult circumstances, being new arrivals into the city from Europe, confused. You know, these are restless spirits. And they were all buried there. And then, as the city grew, the city decided that perhaps they should drain the land and build on it. And so, ignoring the body, they put a powder magazine on that property. The first building there wasn't the jail. It was called the powder magazine, or an arsenal, where they stored gunpowder and weapons to defend the colonial city. Well, in 1780, the British invaded Charleston after a long siege. And as they're approaching, the Patriots realized that they had a once-in-a-lifetime shot at killing off a few Brits. So as the British start to move toward the arsenal, they blow it up. It explodes. There are stories of bodies being thrown blocks and blocks away, all the way over to the rivers. And others burned beyond recognition, most of them British soldiers. They were all buried there. And as far as we know, that was the last recorded burials in the area. So you have a lot of suffering and violent death. And in Charleston, we have a strong influence here of hoodoo. We don't call it voodoo, we call it hoodoo. But it comes from the same sources as New Orleans voodoo. It comes from West Africa. And it is strong. And there is a common belief among the Gullah, which are the people here of African descent who speak their own language. They believe strongly that when you disrespect the bodies of the dead and don't treat them with the kind of respect you would treat your own relatives, that you invite vengeance and wrath from the spirit world. And that's what I believe happened at the jail. And we do encounter spirits who are older than the ones from the jail. They're more obscure, and I've had encounters in the yard myself. And I tell people the yard is just as haunted as the jail itself. I've been charged by shadow spirits, tall shadows that have charged me, trying to intimidate me as I get back in my car late at night. And that's what they do with the guides. They usually wait for the guides to be alone, and then they'll pull stuff on you, trying to scare you away.
Randy, thank you so much for talking with us today and sharing your experiences with us. I know there are other things on your palate or on your radar for possibly down the road investigating. We would love to have you back on again. Can you tell us about anything that you're working on, that you're researching, that you're getting involved with, that maybe we could talk about in a future episode of the program?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, it's something I'm working on. Joy and I have been doing investigations at the jail because it's convenient and it's fruitful. I mean, there's every time we do it, we something happens. You always have encounters with spirits. And so it's a very popular thing. People, and we always encourage people, play. If you enjoyed the jail, please come back and investigation with us. We'd love to have you. But we've been expanding. And there are two venues that I'm working on right now. In fact, I've had meetings with the men in charge of these buildings. One is called the Arsenal or the Powder Magazine, not to be confused with the one I just described at the old jail that preceded the jail. This one still stands. It's on Cumberland Street, Charleston. It's called the Powder Magazine. It's the oldest building, one of the oldest buildings in the city. It was constructed in 1713, and it's now a museum, and we have the rights to go in there and conduct paranormal investigations. And I'm intrigued by the building, and it definitely has a lot of paranormal activity, and it has rich history. I mean, it was used to hold gunpowder and weapons for the colonials. It was then used by the British when they occupied the city. It was later used as a wine cellar by a local wealthy French Huguenot family called the Manigots. And it was also used by the Confederates to store weapons during the Civil War. And it has a rich history, and I'm exploring that now. I don't obviously have as much anecdotal information as I do on the jail, but that stuff comes. And the other one is the Exchange Building at the foot of Broad Street. That's where the dungeon is. And we already have access to the dungeon, and I already have some material on the dungeon. But we've been granted access to the entire building, and we'll be able at some point to do investigations in the entire Exchange Building, which is regarded as one of the most historic buildings in the United States. The dungeon underneath it was built in 1680, but the building on top of it goes back to 1772, and that it's the building where Charlestonians ratified the Constitution. It's where they ratified the Declaration of Independence was read to the citizens of Charleston from the front steps. It's a place where George Washington was entertained in 1791. It was a place where they kept slaves down in the dungeon and were auctioned on a platform that used to stand on the north end of the building. One of the few places in Charleston still standing where slaves were actually auctioned. And it has rich paranormal activity. And it's just waiting to be tapped.
We would love to hear more about those areas of Charleston in another episode as you continue your research and investigations into those areas. I'm excited about talking about those with you. down the road. Randy, thank you so much for joining us here on the Grave Talks today. That's going to wrap up our complete interview and part two of our discussion on the haunted old Charleston jail. Until next time, for the Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening.